Hey guys, it's producer Matt. Just giving you a quick heads up, the first maybe 5 to 10 minutes of this episode, our guest's audio is a little off. We are able to fix it. Just hang tight with us. Thank you so much.
Hey, do you have an idea for a podcast but don't know where to start? Or do you have an already existing podcast that you want to take to the next level? Well, check out weknowpodcasting.com. From concept development to theme music to editing to logos, weknowpodcasting.com is a one-stop shop for all things pod. Don't hesitate to hit us up. We're very nice.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
This week, we're joined by the OG Reaper to discuss our own individual takes on how we define love and how it manifests itself in our daily lives. From the enduring bond between a mother and child to the red-hot passion of a new romantic interest, we open up and have a true heart-to-heart-to-heart on what love means to us. Just kidding, we're talking about Hathaway and the song that you most likely know from the Saturday Night Live sketches.
One hit is all you need to make the money guaranteed. And you can live off royalties forever.
And it makes me wonder, is it just a wonder or is it one hit thunder?
All right, guys, so we're gathered here today to ask the big question, the most important question: what is love? What do you guys think? What is love? We got to get that out of the way before we get into Hathaway.
That's scary. What is love? I think everybody is still trying to figure out love. I talked to my grandpa, and my grandpa has a love-hate relationship with my grandma. He keep her. He loves her. But yeah, love is, I guess, a perception. What you think?
What do you think, Matt? What is love, man?
I mean, I would be someone who would be accused of throwing love around too much. You know what I mean? Like I love people. I love ideas. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just a strong passion of approval.
Well, the dictionary definition of it is an intense feeling of deep affection. And in preparation for this episode, I watched a lot of Hathaway interviews. And I guess he made note of the fact that's always what people ask him first in interviews, and which is why I asked you guys that first. He said the answer, what he tells the people that interview him, is the answer is right there. It's in the song. And the only thing I could figure out that he meant by that is, baby, don't hurt me. I couldn't figure out what he meant. And he's like, oh, it's right there. I'm like,
I don't know. Hold on a second. Let's analyze. I mean, normally we do this in the middle of the show, but I think it's time to analyze lyrics, because I think we've talked about this before. Meatloaf's "I would do anything for love, but I won't do that." The song says what the "that" is when you read the verses, because it'll talk about like all the things that he'll do, and then he'll say one thing that he wouldn't do. But like the thing that he wouldn't do is usually something like forget you. You know what I mean? Like, I'll do anything for love, but I won't forget you. And then like the next verse, it's like something else that like he won't do. So I have a feeling, because I'll say this right now, the verses in this song are actually kind of fire. I couldn't tell you what the lyrics are off the top of my head, but I like the melody of how they're sung. I bet you the answer to what is love is hidden in those verses.
I never thought about it. Maybe what is love, like I'm asking you guys, what's the definition of love? But maybe he's saying it considering, you know, this is in, actually, I forget where he was originally from, but he was very popular in Europe. So saying what is love could be taken in a different way. Like, what's the deal with love? Why love? Why do we want love? It might not be like, what is love? It could be like, why do I want love? Because it just ends in heartbreak, in hurt. That could be the answer.
I want to throw another theory out there, which is that he's just skirting around the question because he didn't actually write the song.
Matt, where are you getting this information that he didn't write the song?
I thought that the song was written by German producers Didi Halligan and Junior Toloro.
Well, what I saw was, yeah, those guys, I think that maybe the beat and the background music, but I think Hathaway wrote the melodies and the lyrics, because about the recording, he said, "We just use ideas that were fresh at the time. I had the idea for the melodies in about 45 minutes, and the total structure of the song was done in about a day and a half." I do believe Hathaway was involved in the writing of this song.
Well, I mean, I feel like the only real way to get to the bottom of this is, Chris, you're going to have to book Hathaway on the Krista Makes a Podcast, and he'll really break it down for us. But yeah. I mean, I think that's fair. I'm sure it was a collaboration between the producers and him. And if he's the one that came up with the melodies, like, again, the beat is great. I'm not going to take away from the fact that the beat is great, but the beat would have been buried and forgotten amongst all of the other 90s Euro pop. But it's that melody of the chorus and the verses that makes people still remember this song almost 30 years since it's been released.
His voices and his melodies. And I remember he said in an interview that originally he didn't want to sing the song or something like that. And the label, it was a label, he did it for a friend, and he recorded it like it was a demo. He wrote the lyrics, recorded it like a demo, and then they was like, you might as well just do it.
Yeah, Hathaway just wanted to be a producer at this time, and his friend was working at a record label, I guess Coconut Records in Germany, and he needed to pay the bills, so they made What Is Love to try to, like, pay the bills. At first, this song was kind of shut down by every radio station. No one wanted to play it, and then one radio station used it as a jingle, and then it caught on. The single sold 30 million copies. He wasn't even intending to be an artist and had this such an enormous hit.
I will say, when I was doing research, my favorite thing about Hathaway is that his debut album was just called The Album.
My favorite thing about this, Matt, was that we're calling this a one-hit wonder, which, yeah, Hathaway's a one-hit wonder to us, but the dude has not only a hit collection volume 1 and a hit collection volume 2, but also an All the Best His Greatest Hits album. The dude has 3 greatest hits collections, and we're calling him a one hit wonder. So I don't know.
We started talking about Hathaway, and I did some research, and I'm like, yo, this guy, of course, What Is Love is powerful, but he got some powerful tracks that were singles, you know. And one thing I like about his voice is, He gave me a blend of a mixture of Seal and Bowie, kind of. That he has a powerful voice, but you can hear him in it. And then when he names his influences, I'm like, I can hear the influences. And what I was surprised is he never mentioned Bowie. And I'm like, he's in that range where it's real strong, powerful vocals, like a Seal.
I think I may have watched one of the same interviews as you did. Gotta say that I came into this thinking that I was gonna, I don't know, make fun of the song, make fun of the guy, watch the interview with him and watch live performances. And I'm like, oh, this guy is for real. He's very down to earth, humble, very cool, talented. And yeah, he has a ton of hits in Europe. We're calling him a one hit wonder because he had one hit in the United States. But we gotta give him a little bit of extra credit because he did have one hit here, but it was a hit kind of twice, thanks to Saturday Night Live and A Night at the Roxbury. This song had its moment in 1993. I don't think it probably didn't go away from pop radio in those few years, but even if it had, by 1998, when A Night at the Roxbury came out, the song was once again a huge thing. So this song was a staple throughout the 90s. It's almost like one song was a two-hit wonder in a way.
Yeah. One of the things that I brought up earlier about the lyrics and the melody and why I really do like them is there's an acoustic cover of this song by, like, an indie artist named James Young, and he does it very sincerely. Like, it's him plucking the guitar and singing this as if it was like a James Taylor song. When you strip away the Euro pop from it and you're just sitting there with the lyrics, you're like, this isn't a bad song. Like, lyrically, it's not a bad song. It's definitely, like, goofishly overproduced at times, but, like, at its core, like, what the song is saying, I'm like, you know what, this could have been, like, the love anthem of a rom-com in 1998. You know what I mean? Like with the right artist covering it, I could see, like, you know, Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks walking off into the sunset with this song playing in the background.
So what is right? What is wrong? Give me a sign. What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Baby, baby, don't hurt me no more. What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Baby, don't hurt me no more.
The I want no other, no other lover. This is our life and our time. If we are together, I need you forever. And is that love? And then it goes into the, like, which also is the verse that I would say points to his answering of what is love.
Like, I mean, to the point of it being, of his voice being like, you're comparing him to Bowie and to Seal, of him having this rock voice. I saw an interview where he says he calls himself an old school rocker. And, you know, he was citing all these, everything from the Rolling Stones to just all this rock music that he really likes. He comes from rock music. And what he said about the style of this song and the style of his music in general was that he knew that he couldn't compete with Michael Jackson or The Police or Prince. So he found something, a certain something that could be his. And that was like club dance music. He made that his. He's very humble. I think he's awesome. I think his voice is cool. I think he's a talented guy. He's very humble about his own ability, though. And he's right. Like, when you're looking at Michael Jackson or Prince or somebody, like, those are the kind of people when you watch them where you're like, oh, I want to quit music forever. You know, so he knew he had a place he could fit. He knew there was a niche where he could fit, and he found it. I think that's pretty cool. He found his place.
Yeah, he definitely was. His voice, once again, he was distinct. Like, he can't compete once again with Michael. By the time he came in, Michael was Michael, you know. Yeah. Like, he was that guy. But like you said, he found this niche. I did see that interview, and that was a good interview. It was like he was like in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
And he was humble. He was really humble, because I mean, a man can really sing.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that takes away from, it's funny because Matt was talking about that, the over-the-topness of the production, which I like. I like the production a lot. But when you watch that video, man, he's leaping by the glass, and he's like popping, dancing, and the girl's popping. And then she bite him. He become a vampire. Like, yeah. And one thing that bugged me out is I'm looking at his other music videos, and it literally looked like they said, okay, cut, and then they go to the next scene, and he got the same clothes on. He looked like Blade in like four of his videos. Like, literally, yeah. Looked like Blade.
Yeah, his music videos are ridiculous. I will say that he looks incredible in them. The one I saw, I think it was for this song Life, which was another like kind of big hit for him, but he's dressed in this like awesome white suit, no shirt under it. He's jacked. He has a cane, like kind of like the dude from Fishbone. And at one point he dumps a giant bowl of milk on his like ripped chest and abs. And then they put it in reverse, and the milk goes back into the bowl. It's just like everything, every cliche thing that you would expect from like a pumping party club anthem of the 90s is in this video. And it's just, it's hilarious, but it's also awesome. You know, like I get it. And it's like that, those images that you're talking about. Yeah. From the What Is Love video. It's perfect. It matches the song. What else is it going to be? You know?
Yeah, that's true.
That interview with him, he's now in his 50s. He's 56 years old. I think he still looks amazing. You know, I watched a performance of him from 2019, and it was a very weird performance. It was him performing at like kind of like some sort of 90s throwback event. I think it was in Germany. He's very popular in Germany. He's got a real Hasselhoff thing going on. He was walking among a very old white crowd where people were kind of like moving to the beat. Some people were sitting there completely stationary in their seats. A large blonde man danced real passionately among a bunch of other seated people. A small chubby child sang into the mic at one point, and he let the child sing into the mic at one point. It was an awkward performance. I don't think that was his wheelhouse, but I'd imagine if this dude went into a club of sweaty 20-year-olds and performed this song, that people would lose their minds. You know, I don't think he necessarily had to be performing at this 90s throwback event, but what do I know about Hathaway's career?
Of course. Yes. I 100% agree. Like, kids, to this day, like that song stands the test of time. You can literally put that anywhere. You could play that in the hood and you're gonna see people in the street like, hey, 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 yeah. And they gonna go crazy because it is what it is. Even Eminem used a sample. He sampled them. And that was epic. Even I saw in the interview Hathaway talks about that. He's like, you know, I don't like Eminem's profanity, but he's a smart guy.
Dude, I wrote down the exact quote from that interview. He said, "Don't be fooled by the bad words. This guy is intelligent." it had that much of an impact that, in 2010, Eminem on a song with Lil Wayne is sampling What Is Love. And it's a very strange sample of the song. I may have not even recognized it at first. They definitely chop it up a good bit, but that's cool. Hey, what I can't believe isn't sampled more, if we're talking about the music of this song, that background, I should have looked up who that background vocalist is, the woman singing in the song, because that, that is to me, I mean, all of it's great, but that to me is the catchiest part. That once it hits that
icing
post-chorus of that whoa from that female voice, oh man, that's
when. Oh my God, powerful, right? Yeah. And she's like weaving in and out of the beat, even when she does the and then he goes in, then he goes back in there, man. Yeah, that song is just, it's magic, man. The other ones are really good, but. And they're just as good, but that one is so much weight on it. It's like layers and layers and layers. Like, it's just not a pumping beat. You hear like the soulful lady in the background. Like, and if you don't pay attention, it's like she's subconsciously singing in your mind. Like, right. She's harmonizing.
All right. So I just looked it up. The female vocal on the track was a stock sample that was released on Zero G's sample compilation CD Data File 1, which was produced by Zero G co-founder and Jack and Chill member Ed Stratton, aka Man Machine, and was aimed at dance producers, DJs, programmers, and artists. So the answer to that question, Chris, is no one knows. It was literally just a stock vocal on a compilation that they sent out to DJs of things they could sample for beats.
Wow. Well, the lady was soulful regardless of, you know, when she was tracking that, it is soulful. And I think that's what cuts through on this. I feel like a lot of dance music can get a little soulless or something. It's just this beat. And it's like, I don't know, but there is between Hathaway's vocals and that sample, there is a soul behind the club beat of this song. And you're right. I think this song could have, you know, transferred over to any style of music. You're right, the melodies are strong. I don't know, I didn't expect to like this song so much looking back on it. I feel like it's always been there as background and goofy movies and at the store and stuff, like and I never paid attention to it, but I'm like, yeah, this is good. This is actually a really, really good song. Like, it kind of won me over. I know that the song, once again, also in 2008, was used in a Super Bowl commercial for Pepsi Max that had LL Cool J, Missy Elliott, Busta Rhymes, but Hathaway himself was not in it. Poor Hathaway.
And I think, like you're saying, all of that stuff that makes this work, I think the fact that Hathaway did want to be a producer over being a singer helps. You know what I mean? Like, it definitely helps in the sense of, like, it is capturing that producer influence from the artist's perspective. Because God knows from listening to, you know, another podcast that you work on, Krista Makes, like, a good producer can make a mediocre song good and a good song great. But if you're going in there with an artist who also has that producer mind working with two other producers, I mean, how can't the combination be, like, magical? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, to that point, if you're coming at writing a song as wanting to be a producer and not necessarily an artist, then you have nothing to think about except the song itself. When you're an artist, you're thinking about so many other things. You're thinking about the way you look. You're thinking about, how am I going to promote this thing? You're thinking about just, there's so many factors in becoming a popular artist. But if you're a producer, all you have to focus on is making that song sound as great as it can sound and be as good as it can be. You're not you don't have to think about anything before or after or any image or anything. Like, yeah, a lot of producers don't look like some famous person. Look at Rick Rubin. You know, look at these people that, like, they're just either completely normal and boring looking or ridiculous looking or, you know, or old, you know. And, you know, so maybe that's a good point, Matt, that him coming at this song when he was writing this song. Yeah, they knew he was going to be the artist that kind of pushed him to do that. But he's still coming at it from the producer standpoint. And also, I thought this was funny. I don't know if you guys saw this, but whoever he was working on this song, they first wanted him to track the vocals trying to sound like Joe Cocker, which is really funny because I can't picture that. And he was just like, no, I can't do a Joe Cocker voice. I don't see how a Joe, like a raspy Joe Cocker, like, what'd you do kind of voice fits in this song at all.
Yeah, no, it's like, yeah, he got that raspy, and then Joe Cocker got that, you got to drag his vocals. This beat is too fast. I can't even imagine somebody trying to sound like him with this high speed tempo. And it goes, and to go back with what you're saying, yeah, like usually a producer looks, you know, I'm a big fan of Rick Rubin, but Rick Rubin looks homeless, you know, so he's like, he looks like he's completely over somewhere else. I mean, Hathaway looked like he did 1,000 crunches before he got in the studio and was like, okay, let's do it. Take his shirt off and just start singing and dancing. Like, when I hear that song, I only imagine him dancing while he's singing a song. He might not have just been dancing, but I can't picture him just staying still.
Well, and I think that an element of that is beyond being a producer. Like, one of the other things that I learned when I was doing the research for him was that, you know, he moved to Germany, dropped out of medical school, moved to Germany, started working at bars, but he then formed a company called Energy that was all about putting together like fashion shows and photo shoots and stuff like that. So I think that there's also that discipline of, like, you're working in an industry where you're photographing people who look good. You can't be walking in there looking homeless. You know what I mean?
Wow. Like, and that's cool, because you saying that, it's kind of like it was preordained, you know, because physically you just gave the physical aspect, but this guy worked in, he has a producer mind state. He works at a bar. He did photo shoots. So it was kind of like his music is designed around fashion shows.
You could hear this song playing in a photo shoot.
Everything.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, as they're like getting the models ready and they have everything set up, like, this is the sound of them yelling things at them to pose as.
Yeah.
Like,
and even walking down the aisle, you know, walking down the aisle, you hear the music. And he had that producer ear where he worked in a bar who was kind of like a club. And then he worked here, he worked there. And with the producer ear, he perfectly constructed and arranged a sound. Like, it's a difference in being, once again, like you said, it's a difference in being a artist and you're just freely expressing, and then you're a producer who has to take an artist role arranging and constructing. It's different. Like, it's artists who have a producer mind state where they know to construct the song, and then you have people who just throw it out and it just sounds never ending.
Yeah.
This song sounds like it's constructed from beginning to end, but it can still, you can play it whenever, but you know when it's going to stop. It's not like it's a old Genesis or progressive rock where, you know, Kansas, where it's going to be super long and it's like 10 minutes. This is constructed from the drum patterns to how he fades in and out, how they even put that sample. Oh, it's literally a construction of a producer's ear where he's like, we're specifically going to do it this way. It's not going to go no further. We're going to have them hard hits and this lady weaving in and out. It's a producer constructed song.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's funny how this guy's life journey led him to a point where, like, yeah, this dude was destined to have a hit. Like, we're talking about, he's in good shape. He's a good looking guy. He's got this soulful, cool voice. Just touching on that Joe Cocker thing one more time. This guy's voice is the polar opposite of Joe Cocker. It's like very rich and smooth. And yeah, you compared him to Seal. Like, yeah, I hear that in his voice. Why would you try to get this guy? This guy is not going to sing a song and sound like he smokes 4 packs a day. You know, he's got that. That's not him at all. You know, so he's fashionable. He worked in that industry. So he's just like a perfect storm of all these things. It just, it makes sense. It makes sense that this would be a hit and this guy would have this career in this style too.
I got a question for the two of you, because my first exposure to this song was through SNL, like from the Roxbury skits. Do you guys have any favorite moments or particular celebrity guests in the Roxbury skit history? I think they did like 30 of them.
Jeez. I don't even remember personally like who the guests were. I was going to talk to you guys about A, was that sketch funny? And like, was it so funny that it deserved an entire movie? I was trying to figure that out. Like,
I loved it.
You loved it?
The movie, I think, is really funny. I did not understand at the time when they announced it. I'm like, really, that one?
I'm not saying I don't think it's funny. I'm just saying that, like, it seems like there's a formula to it, to everything. Is they're dancing to this song, they're bobbing their heads to this song, they're confused about which woman, which one of them the woman is interested in, right? Is this the formula?
Yeah.
The woman comes up, they eventually dance so hard that she like falls over, right? is this the formula of what's going on?
That's pretty much all.
I love it.
I think the bit with the celebrities was usually, they would bring in the different guests and they would constantly having them like the idea was that they were club hopping. So they'd bounce to these different locations. And usually the joke of the sketch was that like each location got more and more and more pathetic until they're like dancing at like an Olive Garden. Like, it's just, yeah, like,
I loved it.
Yeah. But the one that I always remember, I think it was Jim Carrey, was there's a shot where they're in the car and they're bopping their heads in the car. And all of a sudden the record starts to skip and they all stop and he's like, quick, eject. Eject the CD and they hold it up and Jim Carrey in the backseat just leans up and lightly blows on it and then they pop it back in the CD player and it starts again and they go back to bopping their heads. And like that little like 5-second clip has lived rent free in my brain for about 25 years.
I guess it's pretty funny.
It captures time era. You know, it's people who are like us, where we are standing from the outside and we're looking at people like the characters that Will Ferrell and Chris Kattan plays, and you're like, yo, that guy is over the top, man. Why is he dressed? They are real. They are depicting real people in that moment. I seen people. I would go to like Wildwood and it'd be late and I see the people going in the club, the little club, and they look ridiculous. And then even like it's the little parts where I think in the movie he's like, they both look at each other and they're like, Emilio Estevez.
They're flirting with two different girls and they're telling the exact same story of being at a club and seeing Emilio Estevez.
Like, who would be excited to see Emilio? Nothing against him. He did good movies, but that would be the last thing I would think somebody would be like if somebody say, hey, yeah, I saw, you know, I don't know, at that time, Lenny Kravitz or Johnny Depp, he says Emilio Estevez, like, and it's people who are really ridiculous like that. I mean, yep, they still exist in this time. They just don't dress like that no more.
Right. I had an experience like this, and this was in, I think it was when we were recording in the LA area, and for some reason, one night decided to go to one of these types of bars or clubs, you know, like a swanky place where like the dance music is playing, really out of mine and my friends and bandmates' element. But we just went there. It was like somebody took us there, you know? And the one thing I'll always remember about it is there was a guy, he was probably 50, and he was in an all velour suit. Like, you guys know what velour is? Like, they make the sweatsuits. It was like a purple velour suit. He was a little bit intimidating looking to me, but he came up and he told me, he said, hey, will you get me a drink? If you get me a drink, I'll give you some weed. And I was like, I didn't really care about the weed, but I was a little bit intimidated by him or something. Like, I was really out of my element. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Get this guy a drink, whatever. He ordered the most expensive drink that you could possibly order. I think it was $18 drink when I got the bill, and then disappeared. Never saw him again. I mean, I probably wouldn't have even smoked the weed that this guy gave me, but
it probably wasn't $18 worthy weed either. Yeah. Is my guess.
Regardless, it was. I'll never forget that guy. He had like kind of spiky blonde hair and just this velour. I was just intimidated by the way he just fit into this club and told me to buy him a drink. He was so convincing. He used like a Jedi mind trick on me or something, like buy me an $18 drink.
Or fear.
There was a guy in college, my friends had convinced me that every Thursday night I should go to Barnaby's with them because it was college singles night. And they're like, you know, just go. And like, I'm an awkward man. and being in a crowded bar as the sober guy wasn't fixing that at all. But one of the things I remembered about college singles night at Barnaby's was one specific 50-year-old man who was there every single week who looked like a Dick Tracy villain. Like, he looked like a Dick Tracy villain that would have had a name like The Rat. Like, just like long nose, like real, like barely there mustache, short dude, bald. And he would just walk up to a girl and just kind of Night at the Roxbury dance next to them. And then eventually the girl would turn around and give him a look. And he would do the like two hands in the air, like, oops, my bad. And like move over to the next girl and start doing that. Oh. Until eventually he was kicked out of the club every single week.
Living that Roxbury life. That's what you got.
Yeah. One thing I got to always give props to, and it's funny because they look ridiculous, but it's people out there that like you said, would dance up on a chick, and instead of them walking away and feeling bad, they still walk away in style. Like, they're just backing up like, oh, okay. And then the next chick, like, the persistence is godlike. Like, how do you – I'm a regular guy. If I go up to try to dance with a chick, which probably wouldn't happen – I would walk away like, oh man, all right, let me just sit down by the bar. He put his hands up, did like a pause move, like it was still a dance move. The hands up was like, whoa, I surrender. Okay, let's go back. Woo! And then find somebody else.
I envy that sort of confidence. And you, like you're saying, I think all three of us are probably in that boat. That feeling of rejection, I need some recovery time. My recovery time would be a long time. Like, if I worked up the courage to walk up to a girl and whatever that thing is, ask her to dance or ask her out or something and get rejected, it might take me weeks. but these kind of guys that can just be like, all right, I'm moving on to the next one, you know, like, and part of that might be a little bit of liquid courage. You know, I'm sure that, you know, if you have enough drinks that maybe you don't care, but yeah, you don't want to creep anybody out. That we're not saying that, but yeah, you know, there's nothing wrong with asking someone to dance or going up and trying, you know, dancing next to somebody until, you know, I'm not saying grind on them, but I'm saying like dance next to them and maybe you're feeling each other a little bit. That's a whole other thing, but that is like a godlike level of confidence and not giving a fuck. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yes, indeed.
Bringing it back to Hathaway a little bit, I'm looking at what else. When Hathaway was in the charts, and the song peaked at number 11, which it's surprising it only went to number 11. I think maybe it was in preceding years that it got more and more, I don't know, legendary of a song or something. But it peaked at number 11 on October 30th of 1993. Oh, wow, almost Halloween time. Devil's Night. But at that time, the number one song was Dream Lover by Mariah Carey. Also on the charts, as we cited earlier in this episode, number two was I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That by Meatloaf.
Wow.
All That She Wants by Ace of Base was number three. The River of Dreams by Billy Joel was number five. Whoop, There It Is by Tag Team, which has had its resurgence lately, was at number seven. And again, oh, such a good Janet Jackson song, was number nine at that time. So there are some songs that have really stood the test of time in the charts at that time. Whoop, There It Is. I saw a funny thing. I mean, obviously, you guys have seen the... Is that a Geico what's that a commercial?
I don't remember. Yeah. I was talking about this with someone else the other day. I know that there's commercials I like. I can't tell you what they're selling anymore, but
I think it's a Geico. I think it seems like it would be an ice cream commercial, but I think it's a Geico commercial that I saw a funny TikTok of people. I'm sure that it was doctored video, but it was people like throwing stuff through their TV because they always show that commercial on the football games. And it's like, this is what happens when that commercial comes on. Your team's getting destroyed, is like people like breaking their TVs when that commercial comes on. But there's a lot going on. A lot of songs that we all still know today. I mean, that year, the best-selling single was that Meatloaf, I'd Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That, was the biggest single of the year.
It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, when we were talking about how labels push. That's extremely impressive for Hathaway, who was with a label called Coconut. It was a European label.
Yeah.
You know, and he got it. He got to 11 with some of these songs, which I think, like, you just was shocked that Meatloaf was number one, you know, and Meatloaf is great. But that track list, that song is very odd with the names that you just named of the songs, you know, for that to be that high, you know. But it all goes back to label push. It goes back to, you just named Star Power. You know, he didn't have that behind him. And for him to get to 11 with a European label and not the power that these people have, that's big.
And here's the thing. You have to think about, I know you're kind of confused by why Meatloaf was the number one song, but I kind of get it, right? Because we always have to, like, remind ourselves of a few things. First of all, 1993, I always think of it this way. When we were kids in 1993, we were buying albums. We were going out and we were like, if we were into Nirvana, we were buying In Utero. We were going to buy Stone Temple Pilots. So because of that, I don't think the single sales for those artists were nearly as strong as someone like Meatloaf, where, like, our parents, who weren't going to go out and buy Bat Out of Hell 2, but they were kind of into this song that was kind of a big hit, they're going to go out and buy that single because it's like a $4 single. They know they're not going to listen to the other like 10 songs on that CD. They really just want that one. And I think that that's why, like, when you look at the singles charts, I feel like you always have to think, this is not representing the teenagers at all. This is representing the 30, 40-year-old crowd at that time, and like the 10 and under crowd. Like, those are like the people who are buying the individual singles, versus like that 12 to 30 range where, like, we're the album people. Like, we, like, especially in the 90s.
Yeah. I think it's impressive to the point about the Coconut Records that this song at the time was written to try to save the label and studio, because to be able to pay the bills, to even pay the bills. And then this song became, it sold 30 million singles, and the album itself Wow. sold close to 3 million. That's a real rags to riches story for and Hathaway. A lot of people that owe a lot to Hathaway, I think. In this story,
easy. And it goes back once again back to the Meatloaf, you know, and that would make sense. I mean, Meatloaf, the label power, this man had a history with rock since the 70s, you know. Yeah. So to battle with that, I mean, that's impressive. I mean, I could see why he would be number one now, you know, just thinking about it. He's been in the game for so long. I mean, he was almost kind of, he had like a reborn with I'll Do Anything for Love, because nobody was really checking for Meatloaf, you know, at some point, you know. So when he did that, it was like, oh, he's back. It's like his Tina Turner moment. Like, Tina Turner fell off, and then What's Love Got to Do With It? I was just looking at that documentary, which was really good, like a few months back. And I'm like, when the movie came out, it was the 90s. But when What Love Got to Do With It, the song, it was like 1980. I'm like, it was just that resurgence. And I thought, because I wasn't born yet, What's Love Got to Do With the single, I thought that was like the 90s, you know, because it was pushed for so long. And that was like her resurgence. And that was like Meatloaf. Meatloaf's resurgence was his What's Love Got to Do With It was I'll Do Anything for Love, you know. Yeah. So everybody was like, oh, he's back. And then you got the crowd that grew up with him. And then you had new people who looked at him as if he was a new artist. And now the parents can say, hey, I'm putting you on. Yeah, Meatloaf is mine. I'm cool. You know, I'm the cool person. And then everybody goes to his concerts. But that's still impressive that Hathaway stood. You named what? Janet Jackson, Mariah Carey. You named some titans, yeah. Man. And and it goes back to what you said. Coconut Records was crumbling. Like it wasn't. We wouldn't know what Coconut Records still sounds goofy right now. Like,
yeah, yeah. Coconut, I mean, it would be like yeah. That is especially impressive. That's a great point about look what's in the charts. It's Mariah Carey and Janet Jackson. We're talking about the titans of pop music at that time. Yeah. And even now, still today, these are people that are still popular. Yeah. And that'd be like if you and I today were like, man, we're backs against the wall. We need to go make a song on a shoestring budget, make a song, and it blows up. And now we're in the charts with, I don't know, BTS and yeah. whoever else is up there. It's an impressive story. And that's why, you know, we gotta make this decision. And usually I go last on this, but I'm going to go first on it today and say between giving Hathaway the one hit thunder seal of approval or calling it a one hit blunder, I'm saying this dude is pure thunder. And I, from our conversation, I think that you guys are probably going to agree with me, right?
Oh, 100% he brought the thunder. I want to bring up one more thing about the singles just because it just clicked in my head that what I was talking about, like who was buying singles versus who was buying albums, right? We're talking about all these heavy hitters that Hathaway was standing amongst at number 11 on the charts with like the Mariah Careys and the Janet Jacksons and the Billy Joels and so on. But then when you look at what the singles of that year were, like, yeah, Meatloaf, I'll Do Anything for Love. I know you love them to death, but like UB40 Can't Help Falling in Love with You, like not really a band known as an album group. You know, you know what I mean? Four Non-Blondes, What's Up? Coming soon to the feed, I'm sure. And Snow Informer also coming soon to the feed. Like there, you can see the divide on like who is buying the Four Non-Blondes album versus buying the single. And who is like, this Janet Jackson Again song is great. I'm going to pick up the whole album by Janet Jackson.
Yeah, the singles charts really were a who's who of one-hit wonders. And it makes sense because people are just buying for the one song as opposed to the album. Definitely makes sense. That's a good point, Matt.
Real quick over here, the OG Reaper dropping some hot tracks. Where can people go and check out some of the songs that you've been putting out?
You can go to YouTube. It's MC Samson, EMC. EEESAMSON. You type that in and I have a whole catalog. I just dropped a new track. It's called Oliver. I'm dropping a EP in October, beginning of October. So look out for that. And then I have a project right after it. And it's just a great blend of music. It's hip, a lot of hip hop, a lot of I have trippy psychedelic rock tracks. I play guitar. I do everything.
And I mean, obviously, we're having you on for an October episode. It's spooky season, so I got to give a shout out to the fact that you did, I think, two different songs about Tales from the Hood, which is just such a good fucking horror movie. So also just a softball suggestion. Hey, it's October. Go check out Tales from the Hood. It's amazing.
Yes, yes. That I love that you checked that out and you talked about that too. You was like, you shared it on
the Horror Movie Night page. Yeah. Oh, dude, I love that. I think that movie is painfully still relevant.
Oh my god.
Yeah, great
hell
movie.
Oh yeah, you got to check out the OG Reaper songs. Matt sent me a bunch of stuff, dude. So good. So awesome, so unique.
I appreciate it. Yeah, thank
man.
You.
And thanks for coming on today. This was fun.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah. Woo. Woo. Hey yo, welcome to the pits of hell. Only the strong survive while raising havoc. Lost the prodigy, it's time to kill that sickle cell. Raised in the shadows of the darkness where the pistols dwell. Tell from the hood where kids creep up with the missing shells.
This has been One Hit Thunder. One Hit Thunder is hosted by Chris Fafayos of the bands Punchline, Pack, and Another Cheetah, and produced by Matt Kelly of Geekscape.net. Underneath me, you're hearing Tales from the Hood Part 1 by this week's guest, OG Reaper. If you have any interest in podcasting, visit wenopodcasting.com for how Matt and Chris can make your show sound as professional as possible. Let us know your thoughts on the show by emailing us at onehitthunderpodcast@gmail.com and make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on your favorite podcasting app. Tune in next week for another episode of One Hit Thunder.
Hanging on the ops while kids are slain by cops. Cops getting suspended, the mom is picking out plots.
My related murder on camera as people watch. And the cop got to go home to his kids, dog, and wife. Ever find it hard to sleep cause them guns spark at night? Pray it don't hit your home, you don't even turn off the lights. Like mama said that life is a box of chocolates till you get a little older and see they scared of your darkness. The innocence get lost as you swallow whole by the heartless. And you know life matter if color's a walking target, nigga. You can blame it on America, home of the slaves. The whole world is scared of us. We all pawns in the schemes of mass hysteria. Shh, martial law slowly creeping in your area. I know this making niggas face red. Dawn of the dead, this that night of the living base head. Keep quiet, the fires burn from the riots. Enemies want us gone, but our voices could not be silenced. Formulated the plot and put together like science. Niggas don't...
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.